It's called the Arab NATO. What is it exactly? That is one of the questions we'll be asking in this edition of the debate. What is important is that the idea formulated by the U.S. and its Persian Gulf Arab partners was proposed last year but did not get off the ground. The reason it was formed? To counter Iran. Is Iran that powerful that it needs a grouping of countries to counter it with the U.S. backing? And finally, is the U.S. using this group to keep selling its arms? Our guest joining us for this edition of the debate, radio host, journalist, and political activist Don DeBar joins us from New York. And we have writer and lecturer Jonathan Fryer, who joins us from London. Gentlemen, welcome. Let me start with you first, Don DeBar. Trump, it's announced, is seeking to revive what's called an Arab NATO. What is the Arab NATO?
Probably the same function that the European NATO has been serving, primarily, aside from threatening to pursue American interests militarily at gunpoint, which is what NATO has been doing since it was founded in Europe. It's also a place to suck money out of the host countries. You sell weapons sales. We heard in the piece before, you know, it was a record weapons sale by Trump. Before Trump took office, when this idea was also being discussed, there were record weapons sales to Saudi Arabia under the Obama administration as well. The United States doesn't really manufacture a lot of stuff that generates hard cash for exports anymore, except weapons. But the weapons it sells a lot of, and it's big money.
Well, Jonathan Fryer, let's look at a piece of stat here. It's actually a cumulatively speaking pieces of stats on the U.S. in terms of the number of bases that it has across the Middle East. I mean, the last that we checked, the U.S. has 54,000 troops in more than a dozen of Middle Eastern countries, maintaining many military bases, seven of them to be exact. The one in Qatar's Doha is cited to be the biggest one. With this many military bases and this many personnel that's jam-packed with military stuff, as in you name it, from arms to fighter jets, then what function would this Arab NATO serve?
Well, it seems to be at the moment that there is not a very clear picture either in Washington or indeed in Riyadh or Abu Dhabi exactly what this so-called Middle Eastern Strategic Alliance would do. But what does seem to be clear, nonetheless, is that the Americans are very keen, as has been mentioned already on the program, to boost weapons sales and to really have that interest in the region. But I don't see them planning to put more American troops on the ground or Air Force on the ground at all. I think what they're expecting to do, hoping to do, rather as is happening with NATO in Europe, is to get the people on the ground, in other words, the Arab states on the other side of the Persian Gulf from Iran, to shoulder most of the burden. Of course, they hope to involve Egypt and Jordan as well. But although in principle all six Gulf states, Arab Gulf states, are meant to be interested in the program, as your opening piece quite correctly identified, there is lack of enthusiasm, in particular from Oman and Kuwait. And of course, you have a situation with Qatar that it is at the moment isolated by Saudi Arabia and the other members of the so-called quartet. So it's difficult to see the GCC countries coming together to agree to what is going to apparently be proposed at a meeting in Washington, allegedly on October the 12th and 13th.
Right, that's when they're going to talk about this more, I guess. Well, first of all, let's take a step back, Don DeBar, and maybe you can explain to us the role here of the United States. I mean, it's based on what the reports indicate. It says the White House wants to see deeper cooperation on missile defense, military training, counterterrorism, and issues like strengthening regional economic and diplomatic ties between these countries of the Persian Gulf. First of all, why is it that the U.S. thinks that, or why is it that the U.S. is dictating these countries what to do in these different types of areas? What is it about that dictation that these countries have to be under the influence of U.S. for them to listen to it? I'm trying to figure out the U.S. role here.
Well, I mean, the role of the U.S. around the world is to dictate to everyone. That seems to be the consensus among those who articulate policy in Washington, in any event, and they've been doing it for decades now. The relationship between the United States and these particular Middle Eastern countries, of course, is one of, you know, master-slave, principal-agent, form you want it to take. It's one of dominance. And the United States uses the governments that are located in places like Saudi Arabia, if you can call that, you know, group of people a government. Their purpose is to protect the wealth of Americans and Europeans that has been stolen but has not yet been removed from Saudi Arabia in the ground, to protect their right to continue to do that, to exploit the oil and other resources of the area, to keep the people that live there from seeking justice and changing the relationship that they have to their own land and to the people who've usurped it. And so, there's been military assets there, you know, since the 1800s, certainly in the 19th century, when Britain and France and the others were controlling the colonies in the area. And the United States has been there heavily since the First and certainly the Second World War. And, of course, since the 1990 invasion of Iraq, there's been, you know, huge U.S. military resources on the ground. So the role of the U.S. there is to control the resources of the area, to also, looking at the large geopolitical stage, to have that, you know, that many more military assets at China's and Russia's door, and to control what goes on in that part of the world. This is another mechanism we're talking about for doing that. This isn't a novelty in terms of the relationship between these countries in substance, but rather one in form, perhaps.
Okay, I'm going to try to connect some dots, and Jonathan Fryer, help me out if I'm incorrect in doing it in the form and manner that I'm going to do. To use Don DeBar's word, the U.S., either he said the U.S. or Donald Trump, when he was talking about the massive arms deal, to suck money out of some of these countries, especially Saudi Arabia. So if the U.S. wants to do that, then it's got to have an enemy. The enemy that is portrayed here is Iran. So is it okay to conclude that it wants this alliance to counter Iran, to be able to sell it money, and as Don DeBar said, control the resources? So basically not have the U.S. personnel involved in this case in point? Is that accurate to connect the dots in that respect?
To an extent, yes, but I think we have to accept that the Americans have an ideological reason for being there, not just a monetary one. They have firmly lined themselves alongside Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates in particular, with the active encouragement of Benjamin Netanyahu in Israel. Your introductory report correctly said that the idea of a so-called Arab NATO was raised in Riyadh last year, but it was also raised in Israel by Jared Kushner, Mr. Trump's son-in-law, and he has been a key figure in pushing this idea. But what I find really rather disturbing is the way that not only is it ratcheting up the conflict between Iran and the Arab countries of the Persian Gulf, but it is particularly also ratcheting up the division between Sunni and Shia, which has very great risks for stability in the region, not least in countries such as Iraq and Bahrain, of course, where there's such a large Shia population. And I find it absolutely tragic that the Americans are buying this line that's been pushed so hard by the Israelis, that Iran has to be fought against and that it is a danger, basically existential danger, to not just Israel as they see it, but to the wider Arab region as well.
Well, there needs to be some definition. You could review some of the basic ones, Don DeBar, of how Iran has been demonized, what they consider. And they always say Iran's influence. Perhaps you can even define that for us also. I mean, it's not like Iran is shoving down its influence down the throats of the countries in the region, telling them, hey, like us, gravitate towards us. I don't think it's as simple as that, nor is that the case. But to counter Iran, what is Iran doing that they need to counter?
Well, first, it's being independent. That's the greatest offense to the hegemon, is to stand up and have your chart out your own course, which is what Iran has been doing since the revolution in 1979. That was the great offense then, and it has continued to be the great offense. The absurdity of the way the U.S. handles Iran, as opposed to the way it handles the other states, the Arab states in the Middle East, you can see it in several ways. One really easy illustration of it took place in the Southern District Court here in New York City, the federal court system, over the past few years, where the victims of the 9/11 attacks on New York City went to go to court to sue the national actors, the nation states that were involved in the destruction of the World Trade Center towers. And they were not allowed to sue the Saudis, despite the fact that Saudi Arabia had 16 of the 18 16 of their nationals out of the 18 hijackers, or something very close to that number. And Iran had absolutely nothing to do with it, yet Iran was able to be sued, and in fact they secured a judgment, multi-billion-dollar judgment, for a while against Iran, and the Saudis were protected for like 15 years before anyone would let them even be served with papers. That shows you how absurd things are. And in the Middle East itself, you have to ask yourself, why is it that if someone were to drop off a $5 bill in Tehran, they would, Netanyahu would be screaming from the high heavens, but the Saudis can buy $65 billion worth of weapons and there's not a peep that comes out of Tel Aviv? Why is that?
Why is that, Jonathan Fryer?
Well, of course, as soon as one puts Israel in the picture, then it becomes a very murky one indeed, because there is clearly a lot going on behind the scenes, with Israel basically wanting to, as has been mentioned, demonize Iran, and indeed almost encouraging the Americans to not necessarily attack militarily Iran, but to attack it certainly economically. And we've seen that already, of course, by the threats of more sanctions and the US withdrawal from the nuclear deal. But to turn ourselves back to MISA, to the Middle East Strategic Alliance, what the Americans have been saying officially is that they wish to help the Arab states on the other side of the Persian Gulf to basically have a missile shield such as already exists over Israel. And this sort of presupposes that Iran is threatening to send missiles to attack the Arab states, though there has been no evidence that that is at all the case. But actually, from the American point of view, what is more worrying, and one has to understand in order to be able to try to analyze it, is they see what they call a crescent, a Shia crescent, which is going up from Iran through Iraq and Syria and into southern Lebanon. And whereas many people, many viewers of this program, would see that, understand that as a cooperative endeavor for Riyadh and for Washington and, of course, for Tel Aviv, it is seen as threatening.
Well, when we take a look at the aggressors versus the victims, or should I say the aggressors versus the ones that are receiving the aggression, let's do a check here. So we have the war on Yemen, and that's led by Saudi Arabia and its coalition, backed by the U.S. You have Syria, which it speaks for itself as to somewhat what's going on there, even though it's a quagmire. And then, of course, you have what has happened to Iraq. The last time we checked on the bar, Iran has not attacked another country. So it's kind of ironic that these countries want to counter Iran, when I'm guessing that they would fall into the aggressor category.
The United States destroyed Iraq, the infrastructure of it. It bombed it into oblivion. It did the same, by the way, to Libya. Actors acting on behalf of the United States in one fashion or another, the Saudis, Turkey, even Jordan, the Israelis, have done huge, tremendous damage to Syria. You know, the casualties are just unspeakable. The Saudis as the front men, but the US AWACS guiding the air attack against the Yemenis, have millions of people, you know, within, you know, days of starvation and dying from dehydration. This is the effect of U.S. foreign policy in that part of the world. Iran has done nothing comparable to a single piece of real estate in that area except protect its own from an attack, including attack from Iraq back in the 1980s as a U.S. proxy. So the only reason the United States could have a problem with Iran is that it intends the same fate for Iran as the rest of the region, and yet has not been able to visit that upon Iran. And I would just say, in that context, I wouldn't look at the rhetoric that comes out of the Trump administration as signaling a change in policy, other than by looking at the same rhetoric that he was throwing at Korea before the actual apparent, and we're hopeful, but change in policy, where there may actually be room for a real agreement. Because the JCPOA that was signed came into effect January of 2016, and as of the time that Trump took office in January of 2017, there had not been any relief for sanctions, and the U.S. Congress bipartisan action a year ago imposed new sanctions on Iran with across the Congress of 509-5, I think was the vote. So, you know, whatever Trump is, that's not the only target, if he's the target at all. It's been U.S. policy to do this stuff for a very long time, and that's what needs to be focused on and dealt with.
Jonathan Fryer, you talked about how these Persian Gulf countries overall are not getting along. You know, in particular, we could talk about this particular spat, for lack of a better word, that's lasted for a while. That is mainly between Saudi Arabia and Qatar. Of course, the other ones that are also on that bandwagon. How could the disunity there then prove effective when it comes to the so-called Arab NATO plan that they have, if they can't get along amongst each other? And it's pretty severe. It doesn't look like it's going to subside anytime soon.
Indeed. I mean, some commentators in the Arab press in the Gulf have been arguing that potentially this Middle East strategic alliance could lead to reconciliation between particularly Riyadh and Abu Dhabi with Doha. But I personally think actually it's more likely to aggravate the situation, and that in fact the GCC, the Gulf Cooperation Council, is in very dire straits at the moment. And it's interesting, one of the main accusations, if that's the right word to use, that Riyadh and Abu Dhabi were targeting at Doha, at Qatar, was that they were arguing that Qatar was too close to Iran. Now, of course, Qatar and Iran share an enormous gas field, and indeed there has to be quite a lot of cooperation between the two states. But by isolating Qatar, in a sense, the others have pushed Doha even closer to Iran. And therefore, it does seem to me rather unlikely that this so-called Arab NATO is going to be a workable option. I think it rather reminds me of the Baghdad Pact of the 1950s, when the Britain in that stage and the America were trying to encourage Jordan and Iraq to line up against Gamal Abdel Nasser in Egypt and Syria, and of course the putative United Arab Republic, and that fell apart. And I think that this so-called Arab NATO is probably a bit of a non-starter at the moment. And to be quite frank, they shouldn't really be thinking in military terms and military alliances. There are real strains across the Persian Gulf, and the way to cure those is not by ratcheting up the military confrontation, but through diplomacy. And I hope that Europe, including Britain, in this case, will actually be pushing that and encouraging behind the scenes for there to be a more diplomatic approach to the whole issue.
Well, we've got 30 seconds to give to you, Don DeBar. Do you think that the U.S. plan here, as you somewhat indicated, is A, to sell arms, but the selling of arms with the plan of not having U.S. military involved in any possible or potential attack against Iran? Do you think this is a way to militarily approach Iran through the so-called Arab NATO?
The U.S., if it's going to pursue better relations with Russia, which this administration says it wants, cannot have war with Iran. But honestly, there's no way that Trump and Putin can go into a room and have one of them wink at the other one that, yeah, the Saudis bombed Iran, it wasn't us. So that I don't think that that's lurking behind the scenes unless there's a change of administration. If they're going to have better relations between the U.S. and Russia and better relations between the U.S. and China, then what's going to happen is these things will be negotiated part and parcel with the New Silk Road, the String of Pearls, and everything else, the realignment of geopolitical interests in that area towards cooperation. And I think that that is such a powerful, compelling idea that it's going to happen regardless of what the people in Washington and elsewhere want.
Thank you very much for that. We're going to end with our radio host, journalist, and political activist, Don DeBar from New York, and writer and lecturer Jonathan Fryer from London. Thanks for tuning in to another edition of The Debate. For Mika Watawa and the entire team in the capital, Tehran, is goodbye.